So did anyone in the NFL see this second videotape before Monday?
No.
No one in the NFL?
No one in the NFL, to my knowledge, and I've been asked that same question, and the answer to that is no.
The question becomes, did the NFL drop the ball, or was the NFL willfully ignorant about what was on this tape?
Well, we certainly didn't know what was on the tape, but we have been very open and honest, and I have also from 2 weeks ago when I acknowledged that we didn't get this right. That's my responsibility, and I'm accountable for that.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell speaking with CBS News yesterday about what the tape of Ray Rice assaulting his wife says. We're going to talk about the prevalence of abuse in the NFL later in the show. First, President Obama is giving a primetime speech tonight to lay out his strategy for fighting the Islamic State, or ISIS. Earlier this week, the president hosted a dinner and invited several influential foreign policy thinkers to talk about the new strategy. Jane Harman was one of the guests, a former South Bay congresswoman. She specialized in intelligence and foreign affairs. Now Jane Harman runs the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and she joins me now on the line. Welcome.
No, thank you very much. Happy to talk to my local audience.
Excellent. Well, based on what you heard Monday night from the president, what do you expect to hear tonight?
Well, he didn't preview the speech. In fact, he was in intake mode asking the rest of us what we thought. It was a very small dinner, 16 people, seven of them are in his administration, including him, and including the vice president and the secretary of state, very high-level group. And the rest of us were a few people who had think tanks, a former national security advisor, two Republicans. It was a bipartisan group, good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost 3 hours of discussing the threat that ISIL or ISIS poses and what to do about Russia-Ukraine. So the subject of tonight's speech, I certainly got the impression that he will address Syria, not just Iraq. John Kerry was in Iraq today. At least I've seen news reports. He held a press conference and is cautiously optimistic about the new government, which has been in place for 24 hours in Iraq, and its pluralist tendencies, very different from the Maliki government, which alienated the Sunni population and gave ISIS a big opportunity there. On Syria, the president said, and I certainly agree, the problem's much harder.
Mm-hmm.
No one controls the territory where ISIL is massing. The Bashar government, which is one that I view as very negatively, given the fact that it used chemical weapons on its own people and has been responsible for the death of almost 200,000 and the displacement of millions. But Bashar doesn't control the territory we're talking about. And a campaign against a terrorist army, which is how most people are describing ISIL now, is going to be a very tough thing to mount. And so I think tonight the president will announce limited airstrikes. That's been widely reported. And I think I hear that he's going to ask for money to train and equip moderates on the ground there, because there has to be someone to hold the territory if ISIL is defeated.
Limited airstrikes in Syria, over Syria, but over a part of Syria that Bashar al-Assad does not control. Now, talk a little bit about the difficulties in this, because Bashar al-Assad is someone that the United States wanted to target and get rid of. And by attacking ISIS, is that not strengthening Bashar al-Assad?
Well, some argue that it is. Some also argue, there was one person in our meeting who argued that we should form an alliance with him. I somehow don't think that's going to happen. I strongly believe it should not happen. Are we doing him a favor by removing, if it's possible, and we is not just the United States, air power alone, limited strikes can't do this, but we is some coalition of the willing, and there is a number of Arab states and the Arab League that are now saying they will step up. We'll have to see what resources they provide. But we means them, and we means hopefully a well-equipped and trained force of Syrians on the ground. But at any rate, is that going to help Bashar take more territory? I don't think so. I think he has so alienated a large part of Syria that best case for him is he is it remains as mayor of Alawite land. He is an Alawite. That's one of the tribes in Syria. They are about 11 or 12% of the population of Syria. But the large parts of the country have been devastated by this civil war. He is held responsible. They hold him responsible. And I think that it would be a very hard case to argue that in any lifetime, certainly his, that he will become the leader, elected or not, of the entire country of Syria.
Now, the president could, of course, launch airstrikes in Syria without a vote from Congress, and he does face a very divided Congress. Do you think that he should just go ahead and do that if he does not get the reauthorization from Congress to do
this? Well, he's going to do it. I mean, whatever he's going to do, he thinks he has the legal authority to do it. The way he's doing it is he's invoking the 60-day clause under the War Powers Act. The War Powers Act does properly give Congress the right to declare war. That happens to be in our Constitution, but it formalizes it in law. But there is an exemption. Mm-hmm. If there's an immediate danger to the U.S., the president can notify Congress and act on a 60-day basis. The immediate danger to the U.S., among other things, is that two of our citizens were beheaded in Syria. And there are foreign fighters there who could, and I think everyone understands this, both attack in Europe and possibly attack us. At least 100 of the foreign fighters are reported to be Americans who have passports. So that's the immediate danger to us. I think that strategy will not work if we're talking about a long time frame, but it will work for now. And I believe that the president's plan is to ask Congress for an amended authorization to use military force after the election. Sadly, the election is crowding out a lot of stuff. My view is Congress should vote now. Congress should stay in session, craft the right authorization, and vote on it. And I believe, as a voter in Venice, California, that my candidates, it's an open seat, so there is no incumbent, ought to have a position on this. And part of my vote ought to be based on their position. Congress, those who aspire to be in Congress or are in Congress, have a constitutional obligation to declare war. And we're talking about some form of a kinetic campaign using force, including by the U.S., against Syria, or people in Syria.
Now, Dick Cheney, in a speech today at the American Enterprise Institute, said that our president must understand we are at war and that we must do what it takes for as long as it takes to win. What do you make of that statement?
Well, I think the president gets it. I think the war rhetoric of the early Bush administration, much of it from then Vice President Cheney, can be measured by the history of those two wars that we were in. I think a more deliberate approach with a more nuanced strategy has a better chance of success, and I do think that's what President Obama's doing. I represent a nonpartisan think tank, so I'm not trying to be partisan in saying this, but there is recent history here. There is a reason why a huge number of Americans don't want boots on the ground again. And I think that President Obama gets it. I don't think the some of the fights in the Middle East are our fights, but I do think we have a role, we have a requirement to protect American interests. And two lives, many others, but two innocent lives were lost to beheadings in Syria recently, and other lives are threatened, and that is the American interest. And with a coalition of the willing and with a nuanced strategy that includes a political piece. That's what we're doing in Iraq. We used our leverage to get Maliki out and a better government to replace him. I mean, he has a ceremonial role in that government, but he is not running that government anymore. That's the kind of strategy that I think will have a better chance of success.
Jane Harman, President and Chief Executive of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, let's take a closer look at how much of a threat ISIS really is to the United States. The group jeopardizes our interests in the Middle East. You heard Jane Harman say the president will likely argue that ISIS poses an immediate danger to the United States. But does it? Massimo Calabresi is a senior correspondent for Time magazine, and he's looked into the latest intelligence on that very question. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, last week, Matthew Olson, the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, talked about this at the Brookings Institution. And let me just play a little bit of what he had to say.
Now, at this point, we have no credible information that ISIL is planning to attack the United States. We do know that more than 12,000 foreign fighters have flocked to Syria over the past 3 years, including more than 1,000 Europeans and more than 100 Americans. And in our view, any threat to the U.S. homeland from these types of extremists is likely to be limited in scope and scale.
Okay, so what's the takeaway from Olson's message?
Well, Olson's a very sober guy. You'll remember that after the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, his voice was one of the earliest ones to identify it as a terrorist attack and to make some very sober assessments of what had happened there when there was still a lot of confusion. So he speaks with some credibility. He is boiled down, he's essentially saying this is a dangerous and growing threat focused primarily in the region, in Syria and Iraq, with potentially ambitions to target the U.S. here at home, but no immediate plans to do so as far as U.S. intelligence is aware.
So it wasn't like al-Qaeda pre-9/11?
He explicitly said we're not dealing with a force that's like al-Qaeda pre-9/11. There's no known cells. We are not their first priority to attack.
All right. Now let me play another clip of tape from another administration official, this one Attorney General Eric Holder. This is what he had to say last July.
The Syrian conflict has turned that region into a grit cradle of violent extremism. If we wait for our nation's citizens to travel to Syria or to Iraq to become radicalized and to return home, it may be too late to adequately protect our national security.
So it seems like he's saying, okay, well, maybe they don't pose a threat right now, but if we don't do something right now, they could pose a threat later on.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the Justice Department, and particularly FBI, has been very, very active in trying to ensure that people don't go over there. There have been a number of cases that have been brought. I believe it's around a dozen at this point, where nominally interested American citizens found themselves in conversations with people who turned out to be informants for U.S. law enforcement and found themselves arrested after taking steps towards going to join the fight over there. So U.S. Law enforcement officials have been actively trying to sort of beat the bushes, as it were, for people who might want to go over there. They're having a little bit less luck of keeping track of the people who have already gone over there. As Olson said in that tape you played, U.S. intelligence believes, they don't know for sure, that it's more than 100 Americans who may have gone over and joined a variety of different groups or just simply entered the battlefield. They really have no idea how many might be associated with ISIS at this point.
Right. Okay. So I guess through your reporting and through talking to other high-ranking administration officials, is the idea that this is something that we don't really know whether or not is a threat, that we can't really assess it on a very concrete basis? But this is a proactive approach, or is it something that we're using as a pretext to get into this war and attack ISIS militarily?
Well, pretext is might not be quite the right word. One doesn't hear from administration and intelligence officials concrete, high confidence assertions of threats, certainly not against the U.S. homeland from ISIS. The intelligence community's ability to gather information on ISIS plots is very limited because they are fairly technologically savvy, and the U.S. has very few allies and very few intelligence assets in the middle of these fights. It's very, dangerous in Syria and Iraq right now. However, there's no question that this is a rapidly growing, powerful group that is led by a man, al-Baghdadi, who is very ambitious and has been very explicit about having broad aims in the region, and has himself explicitly espoused attacks against the U.S. But as Olson said in his speech, this is not the only group that is ambitious, that's taking territory, that has declared an intention to attack the U.S. and that is led by a sort of a visionary or an ambitious person. There are groups in Yemen. There's a group, obviously, in Nigeria that was in the news last spring. And so one of the things that was sobering about Olson's speech was that he made it clear that ISIS is a threat, they're a problem, but this is sort of one issue in a broad range of national security issues that the U.S. is managing every day.
Massimo Calabresi, senior correspondent for Time Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, what do you think? Is the threat of ISIS overhyped, or do we need to act now proactively? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. You can tweet at us as well, at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, CBS and David Letterman's production company are the latest to be sued by a former intern. Why the entertainment industry has been hit by several intern lawsuits in recent years. That story coming up next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's say you want to get into the entertainment business. You're young. You're willing to do some grunt work. You want to learn. You get hired as an intern. Maybe you're paid. Maybe you're not. But you end up doing the work of a regular employee. What does your boss owe you? That's the question at the heart of a class action lawsuit filed by a former intern against CBS and David Letterman's production company. It's the latest in a wave of intern lawsuits against the entertainment industry. Condé Nast, ICM, and Charlie Rose have also been sued. And 3 years ago, a pair of interns sued Fox after working on Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan. The court found in their favor. Fox is now appealing. Jonathan Handel is an entertainment lawyer and a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter, where he does not work for free. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Good, thanks. Well, tell us about this latest lawsuit by an intern who worked on Letterman's Late Show.
The allegations are that they interned for Letterman, and like really most interns, at least up until recently in the entertainment business, were not paid. They're suing under New York State labor law and saying that they were owed at least minimum wage plus overtime for the overtime hours that they worked. And this follows very much on the heels of the Black Swan case, which you mentioned, which was a federal case brought in federal court in New York.
Well, tell us about the guidelines, because there are some pretty clear and unambiguous rules by the Department of Labor when it comes to interns.
They require, among other things, that the employer gain essentially no benefit from what the intern does, and that the intern gain training, and also that no employees, regular employees, have been displaced or would otherwise have been hired to do the work the interns are doing.
And what do the entertainment companies say? Do they say, well, we're providing an invaluable educational experience and that's the payment?
Yes, that they're providing an invaluable educational experience and a leg up in a tough career market and so forth. And they're saying that the Department of Labor got it wrong, that the test is not as black and white as the department says, but that in fact you have to look at who's getting the primary benefit. And if the interns are getting more benefit than the employers are, then the internship should be okay. Now, there's actually two things going on with that argument. One is that they're arguing that the department got it wrong on the substance of the law. The other is that if the companies are correct, then you have to look at each individual intern and see, did that intern get more benefit or less benefit than the company got? That's critical because it destroys the possibility of a class action. If you've got any complaints, you've got to bring them one by one. That means that there's less monetary risk to the companies. It also means that fewer interns are going to bring cases and they're not going to band together. The hook that the companies and the Department of Labor are hanging their hats on turns out to be a 1947 Supreme Court case That case is still the governing law. And it was a case in which the court actually found that railroad trainees did not have to be paid. But the court said in a very short opinion, it was only six paragraphs, that you don't have to pay these trainees, these railroad brakemen, because they're not displacing employees and the company is not getting, you know, particular amount of benefit from them, and there's close supervision and they're getting training like you'd get in a vocational school, and so forth.
Well, when it comes to Charlie Rose, this issue of back wages was settled. So 189 interns received back wages. So did that suit set some kind of precedent?
No, if a suit gets settled, there really is no precedent being set there, other than perhaps a signal to the industry. And some of the companies that have been sued, and there have been over a dozen lawsuits, a dozen or 15, have begun paying their interns even as they're defending the suits. In fact, I believe Fox now pays interns. Condé Nast, the publishing company, canceled their unpaid internship program. A number of other suits have been settled. So it really looks like at this point, the Black Swan case is the one that's proceeding most quickly. And the case against Hearst, which also was in the Second Circuit, where the district court actually decided in the opposite direction and denied pay to the interns.
Why so many lawsuits against entertainment companies as opposed to any other industry?
Well, entertainment, and there are also publishing and some against fashion designers. And it's because those industries are very aspirational industries. There's an oversupply of people who want to get into them compared to the number of jobs available. There's a culture in some of these industries, certainly in entertainment, of being very harsh on, you know, even on paid employees. You know, the stories of abusive bosses and so forth are kind of rife.
Jonathan, let's talk about the Black Swan case, and that is on appeal right now. Fox is appealing the lower court's decision. What happens if the interns win again?
If the interns win again at the Court of Appeals level, that will be seismic. It really will send a signal to the industry that it's probably time for a change. Now, the Supreme Court may well end up getting the case if the interns win at the Court of Appeals level. The Supreme Court could decide in the opposite direction. But, you know, companies want to stay a little bit away from the very edge of the law. So if the interns win at the Court of Appeals level in the Black Swan case, it really is a seismic victory and could lead to some pretty dramatic change.
Jonathan Handel, entertainment lawyer and contributing editor to The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to know about your intern experiences. Did an internship help you get where you are? Or do you have an internship horror story? Leave us a message, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Or you can join the conversation on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, the Ray Rice domestic violence story is reverberating online with victims talking about why they stayed in abusive relationships. And we'll talk about why the NFL did nothing about other players accused of similar behavior. That's next, after a news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell has been getting a lot of heat over Ray Rice. The Baltimore Ravens running back originally got a 2-game suspension from the league for knocking out his now wife, Janae, in a hotel elevator. A graphic video of the punch has changed all that. But it turns out that Ray Rice is not the only case of an NFL player abusing a spouse or a girlfriend. How has the league been dealing with some of the other domestic abuse cases? Robert Silverman is a sports journalist and contributor to the Daily Beast, and he's been looking into this issue. He joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, what is the league's record on handling these cases of domestic violence, whether they're proven or not?
It's incredibly bad. For years, I mean, the NFL, honestly, until the recent change in policy that followed the Rice suspension, or rather the backlash to the Rice slap on the wrist, the league didn't really have a policy regarding domestic violence incidents. In fact, for the most part, they've responded with a grand total of nothing. Brandon Marshall is a wide receiver for the Chicago Bears and a very good one. He's had a couple of domestic violence incidences, and he's been suspended, I believe, a grand total of one game.
Is this different from other professional sports?
Well, it's a little bit tricky. Each sport will differ on how they treat these things, but I think you can say with pretty clearly that they're all pretty bad about it. They all don't take it as a serious crime, or at least a crime that's worthy in their minds of removing an incredibly valuable asset or a product, and that's how they think of their players as assets and not as people, from the court. The owners work the commissioner's office. The commissioner works for the owners, and the owners don't want to lose their players. This is not something that they think is a detriment to them, or it hasn't been in the past.
Let's talk about the San Francisco 49ers and their defensive lineman, Ray McDonald. And coincidentally, they have the coaches in common. The Harbaughs are both brothers of the Ravens and the 49ers. And so what is happening with Ray McDonald?
Well, Ray McDonald was arrested for domestic abuse. He hasn't been tried or convicted or anything like that, but he was arrested. But the police showed up at around 3 in the morning and found that his pregnant fiance had bruises on her neck and her arm, and that's how he went into custody. The player has said he's innocent, and that's true. You know, he should be innocent until proven guilty. That is something that I think we can all agree on. The problem is, his coach, Mr. Harbaugh, said that if, quote-unquote, if someone physically abuses a woman and or physically or mentally abuses a child, there's no understanding and there's no tolerance for that. And, of course, he played this Sunday.
Greg Hardy, who plays for the Carolina Panthers, has been convicted. And what happened to him in terms of his playing ability for his team?
Yeah, they found him guilty this summer. Now, the thing is that the sentence won't be heard until sometime after the season is over, and so the league is holding off on any suspensions until the sentencing is complete, and that's their policy. But it's a brutal incident. I mean, the transcripts from the trial include, you know, this 24-year-old woman saying, he looked me in my eyes and he told me he was going to kill me. I was so scared I wanted to die. When he loosened his grip slightly, I said, just do it. Kill me. He picked her up and he threw her in a tub. He dragged her across the floor by her hair, and he lifted her over her head, his head, and threw her on a couch. And granted, this is a massive, strong defensive lineman, and the couch, of course, was covered in assault rifles and shotguns.
Wow.
It's the stuff of nightmares. It's the worst situation you could imagine. But because Hardy is appealing, and the appeal won't be heard until after the season is over, the NFL has said that they are not going to do anything.
So do you think that this will all change now that this is getting so much attention?
I think it has to, and I think it will. But the point I want to make, you know, the NFL does have a domestic violence problem. You know, this you can see it on USA Today Sports, and I linked to that in my article. It's a database of all the both the actual arrests and the convictions of NFL players since the year 2000. 83 of them have been for instances of involving domestic violence. NFL players are actually below the national average in terms of the crime rate, or the crime arrest rate, rather. But when it comes to domestic violence, it goes through the roof.
Hmm.
And I think you have to look, as Keith Olbermann said in his comment yesterday, as the NFL is an enabler of this. Because they've never punished the players with the loss of playing time or the loss of a career, the message has been sent that this is not a crime that their employer thinks is serious.
Could steroids have anything to do with this?
Well, I think steroids, yes, could definitely. Performance-enhancing drugs have been known to cause changes in mood and behavior. And I think also brain injury. There is a connection between traumatic brain injury and instances of domestic violence, and there are scientific studies that show this is true. And then again, this brings us back to the NFL, which has not only, you know, the NFL has actively sought to cover up the connection between playing pro football and brain trauma. You don't want to weigh criminal proceedings and say this is better and this is worse. But the damage that's been done to the people who play football for a living, that's the NFL's most stark, glaring crime. That's destroying, that's been destroying hundreds of, you know, up to thousands of lives. We don't even know how many lives that's destroyed. But you only have to look at the incident of a player shooting himself in the chest so that the ME will be able to examine his brain after he's killed himself.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Robert Silverman, sports journalist, contributor to The Daily Beast, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, the reaction to the Ray Rice abuse story took many forms on social media. There was outrage and anger, of course, and calls for the firing of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. It also raised a conversation about abuse victims and why they often decide to stay with their abusers. On Twitter, this discussion played out with the hashtag #WhyIStayed. Alex Goldman is here to talk about that and how the hashtag was accidentally misused. He's host of WNYC's TLDR, which looks at the world through the lens of the internet. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
Tell us more about this Why I Stayed movement on Twitter. And these are very, very personal stories.
Yeah. Essentially, after Janae Rice posted a statement on Instagram defending her husband and sort of criticizing the media, people started this hashtag Why I Stayed, which was just sort of myriad excuses for why people ended up in abusive relationships long after they should have left. And it was really just gut-wrenching to read. There were people saying things like, I thought I wasn't worthy of any other kind of love. I stayed for my children because he had already shredded my self-worth. And it really was sort of a window into a world that not many people get to see because there's so much shame around these kinds of relationships. And so people who were sort of sympathetic to how difficult it is to leave an abusive relationship sort of piped up to say, you know, this is a much larger conversation than just this one punch or just this video. There is a whole framework of sort of demeaning and debasing that goes into abusive relationships that keeps people in them.
Yeah. And I think maybe anger, people were angry, but they were also feeling sorry for her or feeling empathy for her, I should say, because this is sort of a version of Stockholm syndrome in a sense, where you identify with your abuser.
I mean, it's so hard for me to put myself in this situation because it's definitely very far from the world that I've lived in. But it is a really, really difficult situation for a person to extract themselves from. It's not as simple as just, well, there's this evidence of this terrible thing happening to you, you have to leave. It's much more complicated than that. And the internet just tends to simplify things to the lowest common denominator and has a hard time with nuance, especially when we're communicating in 140 characters. And Why I Stayed really conveyed that nuance that a lot of people weren't seeing.
Okay. And so then this unfortunate thing happened with this frozen pizza company, DiGiorno.
Well, frozen pizza companies or any company, they love to latch on to popular hashtags because it's a great way for them to inject themselves into a conversation and to be seen. And DiGiorno saw this hashtag, Why I Stayed, and rather than checking to see what the hashtag was associated with, just tweeted, Why I Stayed, you had pizza. So, yes, it was pretty rough.
Yeah, not so good. So what happened? What did they do?
You know, this has happened before, where companies have tweeted on a hashtag where they really have no business or may not quite understand the gravity of it. Kenneth Cole tweeted during the uprising in Tahrir Square that people are in an uproar in hashtag Cairo because of our new spring line. But in this case, DiGiorno did something that these companies rarely do, which is delete the tweet and then spent the next 12 to 24 hours just tweeting at everyone who was upset with them with a personal response rather than boilerplate corporate language saying, we made a terrible mistake. We're really sorry about this. We didn't pay attention. It's definitely not a mistake we'll make again. This shouldn't reflect on the company. This is the work of one social media person. And just really empathizing with people who have dealt with domestic abuse. And to me, it seemed like one of the most sort of thoughtful corporate moves I've seen on social media, maybe ever.
And by the way, still buy our pizza. mean, the reason that they're doing that is they want people not to not buy their pizza.
Absolutely. But I think that a lot of people tend to think that the internet and the public in general have a very short memory of these kinds of things. So you can just sort of batten down the hatches, not say anything, and it'll blow over. But DiGiorno came out in front of it and just sort of admitted culpability in this really, really public way and is continuing to admit culpability. So in a way, it's keeping the conversation over their screw-up going as a means of apology. So yeah, I mean, their bottom line is that they want to make money, but there are much worse and less thoughtful and less empathetic ways to deal with this. And when you're dealing with a corporation, empathy is usually sort of not at the top of the list of adjectives you use to describe people with.
So the company had no idea what this hashtag was referring to. Is that correct? Or were they just making a tone-deaf joke?
The person had no idea what the hashtag was referring to when they decided to tweet hashtag why I stayed.
They just saw it trending. But how could they not if they just, you know, for 5 seconds, they could look at Twitter and see what people were writing?
Well, yeah, and they shouldn't be totally left off the hook. What happens is at the bottom of every Twitter page, you can see, you know, on the side of every Twitter page, you can see what's trending. And they saw hashtag why I stayed. And rather than to click through and see what people were talking about, they just said, oh, why I stayed. I can put that in a tweet. Mm. And that's what happened.
All right, moving on. Today is officially Internet Slowdown Day. And that's not about the Internet actually slowing down. It's about a political statement about net neutrality. So tell us about that.
A bunch of websites today are putting essentially what amounts to the spinning beach ball, which you're probably familiar with, on their website, sort of in an obstructive way, saying as a way to protest what they see as really, really bad decisions governmentally in the U.S. about net neutrality. So if you visit Reddit or Metafilter or innumerable sites today, you're going to see the spinning beach ball there.
Okay, and here's one. Vimeo is also participating.
I'm Andrea Allen, Director of Production at Vimeo and general video enthusiast. Today, I'd like to talk to you about net neutrality. Net neutrality, what is it? Well, you see, net neutrality is all about a free and open internet.
Okay, so that, I guess, makes the point. What do people want people to do when they come across this internet slowdown symbol?
The idea is that they want to sign a letter to Congress and the FCC and the White House to submit comments to the FCC and just let the government know that they believe that the FCC's recent decisions on net neutrality are bad for consumers. And so they are trying to be as public as they can without making their websites difficult to access, to let people know that they are really against the framework of net neutrality in the U.S. government.
Okay, let's end with something that I think we can all wrap our minds around, and that is chopsticks of the future.
Well, you know, I read this article about these chopsticks, the chopsticks of the future, smart chopsticks, and I thought to myself, this is going to be the dumbest thing I've ever read, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. I'll waste a few brain cells on this. And I found myself surprised that I would come away from an article about smart chopsticks feeling like they were actually a good idea.
Why would you even doubt that?
Well, you know, the way that the article presented it to me was the person who came up with these smart chopsticks said, initially we thought of them as sort of an April Fool's joke, but then once we sort of thought about them, they actually didn't seem like such a bad idea. And essentially what they're designed to do is if you stick them in food, they'll tell you what's in the food.
Everything that's in it?
Yes. I mean, they're still in the prototype phase, definitely. But it'll tell you whether it's spoiled or not, whether there are inedible contents to the food or not, and generally what kind of oil it's cooked in, how old the oil is, things like that. Mm. This may not have huge applications in the U.S., but it's being designed by Baidu, a company in China. And part of the reason that they were designing it is because there have been really, really bad food related deaths in the country over the last 5 years. And there's not really a regulatory system in place to protect people from spoiled food or bad food in China the way there is in the United States.
Well, there are plenty of foodborne related illnesses here in the United States. So I personally would welcome something to tell me if what I'm about to eat is going to give me E. coli or salmonella.
Absolutely. I think that my opinion of them was initially just colored by vessel, which is another smart food-related object, which is a cup that will tell you what's in the cup. So essentially, it'll tell you what you're drinking and how many calories it has, which, you know, if you buy any kind of juice or anything like that, you can just look on the container and it'll tell you what you're drinking and how many calories it has. I've yet to figure out exactly what use vessel has. So I looked at these smart chopsticks and I was like, oh, well, this is the same dumb thing. And then I came out the other side thinking, oh, this is actually really brilliant.
See, that is the genius of technology like Apple and companies like that. They make you want something that yesterday you didn't even know existed or didn't know that you wanted, and now you have to have it.
Well, you know, I thought that Google Glass was totally ridiculous at first. And then PJ, my co-host, pointed me to an NPR report from like the early 80s, right when the Walkman came out. And they had people walking around with Walkmen, and then they were interviewing people on the street saying, what do you think of the people who are wearing these Walkmen? And they're like, they look ridiculous. I don't know why anybody would put those headphones on and walk around like a dope. Those will never catch on. And here we are. 30 years later, and I absolutely cannot be outside of my office or my house without headphones in. So
there you go. Alex Goldman co-hosts the podcast TLDR, and he's also a producer for WNYC's On the Media. Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that coming up on the show, about how technology companies play with your mind and make you want things you thought yesterday were ridiculous. Or is that just late-stage capitalism? Anyway,
you have to play with your mind to get you to buy that stuff.
Warren Olney is here.
We're going to talk about a broken promise today. President Obama on June 30th told the Latinos that because the Republicans weren't doing it, he was going to take executive action and make sweeping immigration reforms. Well, then Democrats in close states who are running for re-election to the Senate, an election in one case, had told him, don't do that. He now is blaming his decision to postpone the decision until after the election on all those kids who came to the border. That has doubly infuriated Latino and Hispanic interests. Who say not only did he break the promise, but he's blaming it all on the kids. So we'll see where that goes.
All right. Looking forward to that at 1 o'clock. To the Point with Warren Olney. And on the show, again, how does an object of ridicule end up becoming a must-have? We'll have that conversation next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Apple introduced its take on a smartwatch yesterday, to which the world responded somewhat derisively. Do we really need a smartwatch? But if history is any guide, there's going to be a point at which the derision leaves the building and we start asking ourselves, why don't I have a smartwatch? How do we come to need something that we would have scoffed at a moment ago? And how are companies using that consumer psychology to get the dollars flowing? Kate Poyner Lamberton is an expert in consumer behavior at the University of Pittsburgh, where she's an associate professor of business. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, nice to have you. So we've seen this play out before, especially with Apple. I remember not so long ago, the iPad was sneered at, laughed at. We made fun of it. There was some kind of late night comedic routine about iPads and the naming of it. Anyway, and now everybody seems to have one. So take us through that process.
Okay, so anytime we see something that's new, we experience something that's kind of scientifically referred to as disfluency. It's hard to process. We don't know exactly what it is. And so our response is to think, well, it's hard to process, and therefore I don't like it. And we'll do that automatically without even thinking about the attributes of something. So you hear a song for the first time, difficult to process, you kind of push it away. However, the more you're exposed to things, the more fluent they become, and that breaks down your aversion to something new. So in the iPad's case, even the derision, even the comic treatments of the product built fluency, creates familiarity, and so that breaks down that initial aversion to dealing with something really new. I think that in that case, Apple also benefited from a little bit of sort of trade convergence. So around the same time, the Nooks and the Kindles were coming out, which mm-hmm. were a similar size, but had much less functionality, right? So suddenly there was something to compare the iPad to that was clearly, you know, not any less cumbersome, but that provided far fewer options for people. So I think that helped it too. It gave it a category in which it was definitely going to win.
This disfluency, is it always the case with something new that we don't like it, or do we ever embrace things that are totally new?
If it's overwhelmingly positive for us, we can get over that cognitive difficulty. What happens in a lot of cases is we don't know enough about it to have the actual nature of the product override the difficulty of processing it. So it's hard to think about, and we misattribute that difficulty to the thing itself. So what happens is you just tend to push away. Now, what's quirky about building fluency is that that can make you even like things, or rather be drawn to things that on their face you don't care about that much. You know, we've all had that experience of turning on the radio and hearing a song that we don't really love, but it's familiar, and you just leave it because it feels good for your brain to process that.
Oh, Lynyrd Skynyrd. Anyway.
right, exactly.
Well, I don't wear a watch, and now I'm thinking, oh, maybe I do want to wear a watch.
Well,
that
didn't take very long. Yeah, and that's what it's going to do. It's going to make the regular watch, our typical nice analog, or perhaps if you're real techie, a nice digital watch, look really pallid, right? In some of the other categories, Apple has created the category, right? They've set all the standards. But we know what a watch is. We have an expectation about what it does, and we don't necessarily expect it to do 10 different things. If they can actually make people feel like those 10 different things need to be done by my watch, then they're going to be golden. And suddenly the market for the regular watch looks much less attractive.
However, there is a product I'm thinking of right now that seems to fly in the face of what you're talking about, and that is Google Glass. People made fun of it, and yet
and they're still making fun of it.
Yeah, right.
Right. That's a little bit more difficult of a sell, in a sense, because glasses are not just about function. They're about fashion, right? Part of the reason people buy something like that is to express a part of their opinion. You know, you might buy the cat eye glasses, you might buy the Lisa Loeb glasses, whatever. But that's a personality expression. It affiliates you with a certain kind of group. Google Glass, because it's being worn as eyewear, is going to do the same thing. It's just that the group it's going to associate with you is not really what everybody wants to be identified with. So that fashion self-signaling function of eyewear works against its acceptance. It's just no one knows what group, you know, that's the group they want to be identified with. What I think is really exciting about Google Glass is that so much of the technology contained in Google Glass can be used for adaptive purposes for people who have different kinds of challenges. And I think it's possible that those products are going to be sort of understood as particularly useful for folks who might need something adaptive.
Okay, but we're not talking about something, we're in this conversation, things that are actually needed. These are luxury items.
Yeah, for most people,
right.
Yes.
And so it comes with identifying, as you said, you want to identify with a group and you want to identify with the cool group. And so that's part of it as well, right? Is that the right people have to be wearing or using the product.
Exactly. And so as with many fashion products, if they get some notable People magazine cover types to actually wear these things and say that they're really cool, that's, of course, going to help. That's kind of standard spokesperson use 101. But it's going to be difficult. I'll also say that they don't have a lot of variation in style, which means everybody's got to be willing to have something that looks very similar. You know, the old, you know, you can have any car as long as it's black is not something people really accept right now. So in the fashion domain, that's a tough sell as well.
So easier to do with a watch when you can switch out the bands.
Easier to do with a watch in part
stuff.
Because it's less visible and also because it's supposed to be functional. You know, there are lots of people, for example, who wear dive watches who aren't divers. They like to wear them. It's okay. It doesn't necessarily status signal for them. So the watch is going to be really interesting. I think Apple has also gotten people used to the idea of carrying around an Apple device, like a Nano or an iPod. So this is just a little bit easier. You just strap it onto your wrist instead of holding it in your hand.
By the way, they officially discontinued the iPod this week, 13 years later.
Amazing. Well, you know, I just went and tried to buy stereo speakers, and you can't buy stereo speakers that basically don't talk to your phone. They all talk to your phone now. And that's another thing that Apple is doing. They're integrating all this technology so that you have to have one piece to make the other piece work. And that ties in people for the long run.
Kate Pointer Lamberton, Associate Professor of Business and expert in consumer behavior at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Go out and get your Google Glasses, don't you think?
I think I'll be waiting on that one. Thanks.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Jolie Myers, get your Google Glasses. I mean, come on.
I'm going to try to see how many Google Watches I can fit on my arm any given time. I'm going to tell the time so hard. So on a more serious note, we talked today about the Why I Stayed hashtag. Mm-hmm. And we asked our listeners what they thought about the conversation happening on social media. Melissa Jordan Dahmer says on Facebook that Why I Stay, this conversation is really important. Abusers make you feel like you have no choice. The mental manipulation that goes in these relationships is hard to understand if you've never been in an abusive relationship. So this is kind of a teaching moment for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But Connor Briggs Desai wonders why we're still asking victims to explain themselves. Victims shouldn't have to explain why they stayed. Kiana Moore on Twitter agreed. She says that it's heartbreaking that survivors of domestic violence feel as though they need to explain themselves with this hashtag. Vicky Tiki Tabby tweeted us as well, and she says that it took social media to make this part of the conversation. The media itself likes to boil things down to simple black and white. The Why I Stayed conversation shows how complicated this stuff really is. And Charlie B shared her own hashtag Why I Stayed story on our Facebook page today. She says, Why I Stayed? Because my partner made me feel so insecure, I didn't know I deserved better. And I lived in fear of what they would do to me if I left. Mm.
Wow. Okay. Powerful stories. You can leave yours if you want at our Facebook page or read the ones that are there. KCRW Press Play. Jolie Myers, thank you very much for that. Warren Olney and To The Point up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.